Satipanno Panavato Savaka Sangha. But just a little bit about Sangha, which is probably a term that, if you know anything, you know about. In early Indian languages, Sangha simply means a gathering, a collection of people. Sun, again, that prefix, which is equivalent to con in English. Latin. So, yes, it has the general meaning of an assembly, a gathering, especially of people, but not necessarily only. And sure enough, in modern Indian languages, that's what it means. Again, something worth knowing if you have anything to do with India, and we all do in England today, because there are so many Indians here. And in fact, Sangha has a somewhat unfortunate resonance for Buddhists in India, because the right-wing Hindu nationalist movement, which is very large, is called the Sangh Parivar, the family, the Sangha family. As the newspapers call it, the Saffron Brigade. So it's the RSS, which is the largest non-government organisation in the world, a very highly organised sort of quasi-fascist organisation, putting it a bit in a wrong context. So anyway, it's got this sort of very wide range of associations, and it can simply mean our society, even almost a firm or a company. But in the Buddhist context, it gains a very particular meaning. And in this text, that meaning is made very clear. But it's not just Sangha, it's Savaka Sangha. Savaka means hearer. It's often translated as disciple, but it literally means hearer. The one who listens, the one who hears. So it's the Sangha of the hearers of Bhagavato, of the of the Buddha. Bhagava, we've seen, is the word often translated as blessed one, which isn't really quite it, but it's this redolence with remarkable qualities of sort of spiritual vitality or power. So it's that the assembly, the collection of those who listen to the Buddha, the blessed one. It's very, very significant terminology, because of course it transcends the idea of Sangha, the narrow idea of Sangha that's sometimes held in the Buddhist East as the community of, well, especially monks, not even monks and nuns. So it makes quite clear it's everybody who listens to, and listens to here obviously means with a receptive ear, the Buddha. Hearing is a great deal of importance is given to hearing in the Buddhist tradition. So you get the three levels of prajna. You come across this, three levels of prajna. So the suttamayi prajna, which means the wisdom that comes from hearing or listening. Tintamayi prajna, the wisdom that comes from reflection. And bhavanamayi prajna, which is the wisdom that comes from contemplation, you could say, taking teachings deeply into your own experience, especially through meditation. So there's a sort of progression that, first of all, you listen to what the Buddha has to say. You listen to his Dhamma. You listen to make sure that you've understood it correctly, that you've got it clear. Then you think about it. You weigh it up to see whether you agree or not, to see whether you can understand fully what it means. There's no point in arguing with it before you've actually got it, if you see what I mean, before you've worked out what is actually being said, although we often do that. So you reflect upon it. You try to sort of see its implications, see what it means for you, see what it means for your life, for your actions. And then you meditate. you become deeply concentrated, and in that deeply concentrated state you allow the Dhamma to penetrate into you, to soak into you. So the first step, the first stage, is to listen to those who have penetrated the Dhamma for themselves, and especially to listen to the Buddha as the one who, beneath the Bodhi tree, realized the Dhamma directly for himself and then communicated the Dhamma as we saw yesterday. So, Upadaka Sangho is us, at least potentially us. We are the ones who are listening to the teaching of the Buddha, listening with a receptive ear. Doesn't mean with an uncritical ear or a blind ear, that's the word, an ear of blind faith. Listening on the assumption that something is being said, if you see what I mean, that something worthwhile is being said. When somebody like the Buddha speaks, you're starting off with an assumption that probably he knows what he's talking about. You may in the end find that you don't agree or you can't go along with it, but you start off with an attempt to discover what it is that he really means. So that's the implication of sadhaka. Of course, it has a little bit more of a sense of a faithful hearing, not merely a receptive, but faithful, that you already have quite a lot of conviction that what the Buddha is saying is the Dhamma, is the truth. So, the first, the five lines of the text are about the hearers of the community of hearers of the Buddha. And we're told what they're like. Now, when we say hearers of the Buddha, of course that includes us. It includes all those who are trying to pay attention to the Buddha as the Buddha, as somebody who has attained the enlightenment, has seen reality as it is. But especially in this context, it means those who are not merely receptive to it, but who have a deep conviction from their own experience that this is the truth. In other words, in whom pasada has arisen, that quality of faith has arisen. In other words, those who are stream entrants and beyond. So the Sangha as a refuge is those who have gained stream entry and beyond. It's very, very important, because particularly in Eastern Buddhism, sometimes the Sangha is identified purely with the Bhikshu Sangha. And although there are many very worthy monks, there are many rogues, I know from my own experience. I would say, as a rough estimate, that probably 80% of Bhikshus in India are verging on the rogue. They're there to basically, they're often sadhus, Hindu sadhus, who simply become Buddhists when they're hanging around the holy places. You can't take the robe as an indicator of genuine spiritual commitment, unfortunately. In some places it's better than in others, and probably in countries where for instance, in Thailand, many young men join the Sangha because you get a free education. So once they've got their first degree or their higher degree, they leave the Sangha, they leave the order. So in the Far East, in the East, there's often, especially in Theravada, there's often quite a bit of confusion of what the Sangha means. Yes, it's quite clear what is it. What the Sangha is as a refuge is those who have gone, attained stream entry and beyond. Those who are irreversible in the Dhamma. Those who've woken up to the true nature of things. Have a great deal of work to do to complete that realization, but they've broken through. So, well, in our own context, you can't go for refuge to the order. If you did, you'd be a pretty good fool. Because it doesn't consist only of stream entrance, if it consists of any at all, which we won't go into. But we don't set ourselves up to be a sangha as refuge. We say it's not, in that sense, a real sangha. It's an effective sangha in Sangha Rakshita's gradation. So you can't utterly rely necessarily any order member in the way that you could rely completely on any stream entrance, should you be able to identify them. Which, in a sense, of course, is not really possible to do unless you are one. Catch 22. The sangha that's being spoken of here is the sangha as a refuge, which means the sangha as those who are stream entrants and once returners, non-returners, and aryas, arahats, the arya sangha, or to expand the reference, the bodhisattva sangha. So we're given the characteristics of the real sangha. But those characteristics of the real sangha are the guiding principles for an effective sangha, if you see what I mean. An effective sangha should be trying to turn itself into a real sangha. So the description, the definition that's given of a real sangha is the guiding ideal for an effective sangha, and for you as individuals who want to join that sangha, who want to be recognised as going for refuge effectively and take your place within that effective sangha. This is what we aspire to be, and frequently fall down in. It's what we aspire to be. It's quite important. I think that it's in some ways quite easy to go for refuge to the Buddha, to have an ideal of a transformed individual. It's quite easy in a certain sense to have to go for refuge to the Dhamma, a particular personal path. But what's most difficult is to conceive of the possibility of an ideal society. Most of us have been betrayed too many times. And I've just read Stalin. I've seen what happened to the Russians. They were betrayed by a very, very noble and lofty ideal of true equality and justice. And it became a bloodbath. We've seen so many ideal societies posited and so many betrayed. So it's one of the most disillusioning things. And probably any of you who've been around any organisations and so forth, maybe even around Buddhist movements, maybe even around the Tri Ratna, you have your moments of disillusion. I certainly have. When you really begin to think, is this possible? Is this, you know, genuine? Are these not just people who are deluding themselves? Look what happens. You know, here you find this, here you find that. I think the you could say it's the last temptation to disillusionment is disillusionment with the ideal society. Do you see what I mean? That it's quite easy to retain an ideal of a personal transformation, of even of a truth, but to retain some genuine idealism about human society is pretty difficult, considering the mess that human beings get into with each other and make of each other and of others. But my own experience, my direct experience, because I've had my moments of disillusion, being of a, unfortunately, a cynical turn, it's the most deeply disillusioning experience you can have, in my sense, that you just feel bitterly, bitterly disappointed. And it undoes the others in a way. So what the third jewel, I think, does to the three jewels, that does to the other two jewels, it says that It's not just possible for individuals to do this, but that a number of individuals have done this through the centuries, and they come into a new and special relationship with each other, which is the ideal of human communication, human association that we all so long for. A genuine peace, a genuine harmony, genuine understanding, real openness, honesty, and so forth. So I think the third jewel is the hardest to keep shiny. In a way, it's the one that you most directly experience at its best, but it's the one that's easiest to be disillusioned with. And what I sincerely hope, and I still believe is the case, is that unless that flame of a vision of an ideal society is kept alive in a sangha, in an order, you could say, in a movement, it just becomes worthless. The other jewels fade. Get my point? So I think that it's extremely important to be realistic about the real nature of the order, the movement that you're engaged with, to be quite conscious of its shortcomings and its failings, not to pretend, you know, we've seen that, everything's lovely, everything's wonderful, everything's rosy, and then slowly the worms begin to be seen in the midst of the roses, and you begin to realise the other side of it, and then the whole picture can go dark and disillusioned. So one needs a very realistic perspective on the Sangha one is involved with, but at the same time an ideal perspective, seeing that there is still a striving for, a struggling for an ideal society, and occasionally moments when that flowers, maybe quite long moments, maybe moments when a few people attain to that ideal Sangha, and then it falls away again. Maybe moments when we all attain to it, and then we fall away from it. But something we're constantly trying to bring into existence amongst us. So, it's very important that we separate the effective Sangha that we are engaged with, together, from the real Sangha, but that we don't separate it completely. It's only an effective Sangha because there's an orientation to the real Sangha. So what is it? What is the real Sangha like? Well, it's supatipanno. Patipanno is patipa is going or proceeding. So moving forward. That's very important, isn't it? That a real Sangha is moving forward. It's becoming something more all the time. If it stands still, it moves back. It cannot but grow. So that the Sangha is striving all the time for a greater manifestation of harmony, of peace, of understanding, and so forth. It's always proceeding forward. And it's proceeding forward, su, again, that prefix that you find in my name, Subhuti, which means well, happy, good, even perhaps ideal, but especially it has the connotation of happy. The Bhagavato Savaka Sangha, the fellowship of the hearers of the ideal human being, the ideal person, is proceeding forward, is growing in a happy way. And I suppose that the qualities that I talked of in as pasada, which characterise the stream entrant, if you remember, has perfect faith, pasada, in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. So, and that posada is not merely a sense of conviction. It's very calm, very steady, very stable, very loving, very light, and very happy, very serene. So they're proceeding serenely. That's a nice way of putting it. They're going along in a not in an anxious or driven way. There's a sense of ease, a sense of contentment, a sense of relaxed commitment, alertness, forward movement. That's the nature of it. So you could expect, if a sangha was a real sangha, that the overall atmosphere would be a positive one. You'd have a sense of people being happy in a real sense, not happy because they've conquered their enemies or got whatever it was that they wanted, but happy because something has flowered within them, and something has flowered between them. So you'd expect that sort of atmosphere in a genuine sangha. The mood of happiness coming from true faith, which is not forced, not suppressing doubt, but which is based on a direct experience of the truth. So there you are, Supatipanno, the true sangha, those who listen to the Buddha and carry out his teaching, is a happy one. And it's moving forwards. By the way, it's interesting, isn't it, that the stream entrant, the once returner and the non-returner, all referred to as savakas. Something that sort of dawned on me recently, that in the Pali Canon, those under training are the stream entrants. You really, in a way, only enter the training when you gain stream entry. So you're in training until full enlightenment. Okay, so that's the first characteristic of the Savaka Sangha. The second characteristic is Uju Patipanno. So again, moving forward, Uju is a word which sort of means what it sounds like. To me, Uju sounds sort of blunt, direct, straightforward. And that's what it means. It means direct, straight, upright. It can mean upright in the moral sense as well as in the backbone straight sense. But yes, it means not messing about, not compromising, going for the heart of the matter, not getting diverted. Yes, you're not all the time very seriously and piously reading Dhamma books, but the central focus of your life is the practice of the Dhamma is the work to grow spiritually. So the Sangha will be characterized by a mood of seriousness, if you like, of a seriousness of intention, but it's su, so it's going to be a happy mood of seriousness and focus. It's not po-faced or pious, but people are getting on with the heart of the matter. They mean business. They're not mucking about. They're not in it for the power and the glory, which we know there's buckets of in the Sri Ratna. They're certainly not in it for the money. They're in it because they care about the Dhamma and its principles, and everything they're doing is not too far away from the activation of the Dhamma. That is the characteristic of the real Sangha. And the effective sangha is only really an effective, or is only really an effective sangha when it has this characteristic. When individuals within it are really applying themselves to the practice of the Dhamma. We'll look more at this in a while. But course, this strikes at the issue of rites and rituals. Silavata Paramasa, dependence on rites and rituals, the third fetta, where you're going through the motions. You know, you're sitting in meditation, your back is very straight, but really you're just wool gathering or planning. I remember reading an account by a Westerner who'd spent quite a long time, many years, in Japanese monasteries, and he realised after a while that all the monks he admired most had learned how to go to sleep with their backs bolt upright and their eyes open. So you can very easily sort of be on the cushion and be really impressive, and everybody's thinking, wow, he's really into it. You're sitting there for hours and hours. Actually, you're not really applying yourself at all. And so on. Well, you can be very, very knowledgeable about the Dhamma. You can give brilliant talks about the Dhamma, but you're not really putting it into practice. And so on. Or institutions that are meant to be serving the Dhamma can very easily, and it happens even amongst us, very easily become diverted into other issues. Maybe even good things, but things that aren't really the heart of the matter. Well, Bhante says, doesn't he, that the good is the enemy of the best. So, for instance, we find this in India, that we have social work institutions. It's very, very important that we do have those because people have such great need that we must respond to it. But you can easily fulfill yourself through doing that. You can easily feel that you're really doing what you came here to do and miss a point that lies behind that, if you see what I mean, which is self-transcendence. So you're making yourself feel quite good because you're helping others. But you're not really transcending yourself. So yes, the sangha, the true sangha, is characterized by uju, by this directness, this straightness, this real application of the Dhamma to life. Not to say that you don't have your diversions and distractions, but for many of us, life is distraction. Even our Dhamma life can be distraction. It's, you know, all the books you can read on the Dhamma. So many books nowadays. You can have a wonderful Dhamma life, which is just reading loads and loads of books, and it's not really a Dhamma life at all. Or fascinated by all the highways and byways of meditation. But you're not really using meditation to break through into reality. You could be coursing in very, very positive, pleasant mental states, believe it or not, but not really getting through to the root of the matter. So yes, the Savaka Sangha, in the sense of the genuine Sangha, the real Sangha, is characterized by an application of the Dhamma very directly to life. Yes, sometimes uju is used in translation as in a somewhat sort of moralistic sense. They're all very good. It's not really that at all. It's more this application of the Dhamma to life and experience. Then it's nyaya patipanno. So it's proceeding. Nyaya means methodically or in an ordered way. There's a whole school of Indian logic called nyaya, which was derived from Buddhism and fought Buddhism, and it's to do with logical argument. So nyaya means orderly procedures, as it were. And here what it means is that you're applying the Dhamma in a methodical way, what Bhante calls regular steps. So, you know, for instance, a lot of people are very strongly attracted by the Buddhists and Bodhisattvas, the archetypal Buddhists and Bodhisattvas, and that's very, very good. But really, unless you appreciate the historical Buddha, those Buddhists and Bodhisattvas have only a sort of a mundane archetypal significance, a Jungian significance, if you like. So you need to have a very strong feeling for the Buddha for those archetypal figures to really have significance, to take a topical issue, an issue that's under debate. It's not that those figures are not deeply significant and even very, very important in Dhamma life. But you can only really understand them if you've understood the Buddha, and if you have a strong sort of connection with the Buddha, because they emerge out of his experience. And if you don't appreciate that, then they are for you merely very powerful archetypal figures. So you can see this in many, many different fields. There's, you will not progress much with meditation unless you've looked very strongly at your ethical conduct, the way you live your life, your relationships to other people, your daily interaction with the world. Unless you've looked at that, your meditation will not go very far. And you will not be able to translate your intellectual understanding into real existential experience unless you've got a deep integration of mind, which comes from meditation practice. So the sangha, the true sangha, is putting things in order. It's getting all the steps and stages in the right order. You know, we inevitably come from here and there. We're attracted by this, we're attracted by that, we like this, we like that. But a point comes where you have to put it all into regular order, and then it will unfold. One thing naturally unfolds from another. Well, to give you a topical point, well, topical to me, because I've been thinking about it, the Buddha talks in the Arya Paryasana Sutta and many other suttas about concentration arising entirely naturally and spontaneously from a happy state of mind. Why can't you concentrate? Because you're not really sufficiently positive and happy. That's the truth of it, brothers. If we were living a better life, a more innocent life, we'd spend more of our time in very happy mental states. When we sat down with nothing particular to do, don't even have to give much attention to your breath, you just naturally fall into a very pleasant, very positive state, and it just takes a little bit of effort to push that a bit further. I'd say that was my own experience. In those periods of my life when I managed to get a reasonable degree of innocence, meditation is easy. But when there's conflict in my mind, conflict in my heart, more especially, then meditation's a torment. So, what the Buddha is talking about is going with the natural facts of human experience, if you see what I mean. There is a natural order in which things unfold, and what the Dhamma teaches you is how that unfoldment takes place. Of course, there's lots of variation, and individuals are different, and so forth. But in the end, you've got to get it all stacked up. You can't put the roof up without the foundations. You get a bit of the roof sort of hanging there on a single beam, but it won't be keep the weather out. So you have to sort of eventually proceed nyaya, and that's the characteristic of the community of stream entrance. They're putting things together in the right order, so that it all unfolds, which requires quite a degree of understanding and quite a degree of self-mastery. Not mastery in the sense of gritting your teeth, but of having understood yourself, integrated yourself, come to terms with yourself, being at peace with yourself. So, yeah, that's a strong characteristic of the true Sangha, that people are working with conditions in an intelligent and prudent way. They're seeing the way in which the conditions that build the spiritual life work and going along with them. Then the Samichi Patipanno. This is usually, well, even here it's called correctly proceeding. But it's not really that. I'm following Sangharakshita here. But Sami is correct, Samichi. Is connected with the word samma that we had in samyak sambuddha, samma sambuddha. Samma meaning integral, whole, complete. So in this context, what it means is harmonious, together, as we might say, integrated in the sense of socially integrated. Everybody is in harmony with everybody else. Everybody's at peace with everybody else. Everybody respects and honours everybody else as an individual. It's a mood of true brotherhood. That is shared within the entire community. How does that come about? What makes for harmony? It's very striking in all community life, in all social life, how easy it is for divisions to come. Divisions that are based on, of course, cultural matters, all different kinds. Divisions that are based on personality differences, divisions that are based on communication difficulties, and so on and so forth. There's so much that easily comes between us. Even kind of instinctive repulsions. I don't know whether you find that sometimes you sort of notice that you've taken exception to somebody. For quite superficial reasons. I don't like the shape of his nose sort of thing. I don't like the way he stands. If you're of a somewhat more of a hate type than a greed type, I confess it all. That's an experience, something I have to work with. I've had to work with. It's not so bad these days. But just sort of finding I've kind of, my teeth are on edge. And the poor guy's a perfectly decent person, but something set my teeth on edge, and that's going on all the time amongst us, instinctive level, at a conditioned level. They remind you of something nasty that happened in your childhood or whatever. There's so much that easily breaks up human society, and if you ever lived in a village, I was brought up in a village, you know just how much division and so forth there is. I live in a village now in Wales, and I get all the gossip from every side because I'm an outsider. And I've seen it in Spain and in India. It just, you know, the archers just don't get it. So what is it that creates harmony? It's of course having a sense of something shared that is greater than the differences. The differences become relatively superficial the more you share something. So, you know, I brought up immediately after the Second World War, and I remember so many adults sort of speaking about the spirit that was in Britain in the war, and what an incredible sense of camaraderie there was, and how close people felt. Oh yes, on the way over, day before yesterday, I heard a programme about a reunion of people involved with UNHCR in Sarajevo. And very, very striking, they were all speaking more than anything of the sense of camaraderie amongst them. That very, very difficult situation where they were doing something unambiguously good. I'm not saying that about the war, but in a way it was, if ever, a war can be just coming close to it. So it's when you have something shared in common that you begin to be able to surmount those things that divide you. And, the genuine Sangha has the deepest and most incontrovertible and most abiding ideal in common, the ideal of enlightenment, the ideal of Dhamma. They have the Dhamma in common. So the more we share the Dhamma, the more we're conscious of sharing the Dhamma, the more we will be united. And you can sometimes get a sense of that. I often have been involved in the past. I was order convener, international order convener, and I was often involved in trying to resolve disputes and difficulties. And, I'd try all sorts of different things. Trying to get people to listen to each other, trying to unpack all the issues and all the rest of it. And in the end, what I always found was most effective was getting people to go on retreat together, study the Dhamma together, or meditate together, or something of that kind, where people had an experience of what they had most deeply in common. And against that, the issues that divided them became relatively superficial. So the community of stream entrance and beyond is what's the word for it? Irreversibly united, because they all share and know they share the Dhamma very, very deeply and strongly in common. So harmony for them comes from sharing something that goes beyond them as individuals, that in a sense even denies them as individuals, that or denies their clinging to themselves as individuals, that they're all participating in together. Yes, our Sangha is an effective Sangha to the extent that we do share a strong sense of having the same ideals, living ideals, not merely verbal ideals, not merely lip service, but you sense in the other person the same fire that animates you. And that's what we're looking for in you. We've asked for ordination. We're looking to see whether you've got that alive in you enough for it to remain effective, which means that even though it may die down a bit, as it does with us, it's not that difficult for it to be reignited when the right circumstances come, and that you yourself will continue to make the efforts to bring about those circumstances. So Samicca Paticcana has this sense. It's going forward harmoniously. It's moving along harmoniously because it's united in the most profound ideals in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, in the sense that are being set out here. So, then Yadidam Chatari Purisa Yugani Atta Purisa Pugala. Chattari is four. It consists of four pairs of persons. Purisa again is individual or human being or whatever. Four kinds of pairs. Yugani is pairs, and Atta Purisa Pugala. Atta is eight. It still is in modern Indian languages. Purisa Pugala. Eight individuals. So it consists of four pairs and eight individuals. Kinds of pairs, eight individuals. In other words, the four pairs are stream entrants, once returners, non-returners, and arahats. The pairing of that is each has one who's attained the path of stream entry and one who's attained the fruit. This is an arcane distinction which you needn't trouble yourself with much, whether you even need to trouble yourself with all the gradations is another question too. But it's said that attainment of each of these stages first of all has an attainment stage. So you've actually reached there, but you're not experiencing the benefits, as it were. The fruits haven't started to mature in you. So something's changed inside you, but it hasn't yet begun to manifest in your experience and in your action. The two are inevitable. The connection is inevitable. If you've got the path, you've got the fruit. So this is probably a relatively late distinction, which it sheds an interesting light on the whole text. It's clearly an amplification of something very early. But that's another question. So, yes, these four kinds of people are known as the Aryas. Bhante says that really the important one, from a practical point of view, is the stream entrant. It's the one in whom sufficient insight has arisen into the insubstantial nature of selfhood for one to let go of clinging effectively. So you're clinging to self, that is. You cannot be fooled anymore by your own kind of habitual thinking of I am real, I am ultimately real. And that enables a new set of processes to unfold. I talked about this in the paper on revering the Dhamma. It's the Dhamma Niyama processes begin to unfold quite spontaneously, without you doing them, so to speak. Something more than you begins to unfold within you, which you can only hasten by cooperating with, if you see what I mean. You can kind of delay it, but you can't prevent it. But you can delay it by not directly going, not working with it. So, yeah, that's the operative thing. It consists of the true Sangha consists of those who have let go of self-clinging to the point at which a new set of conditioned processes unfold within them. The conditioned processes that lead forward irresistibly to full and perfect enlightenment, the Dhamma Niyama processes. This is a familiar idea, I think. We've been talking about it quite a bit recently. So that's the character of the true Sangha. Its members are in touch with something that's more than them, in a narrow sense. It's not exactly not them, but it's not merely them. It is definitely happening to them, in them, and it's not something else or somebody else, but it's not willed. It's not motivated by a constructed I. It happens naturally, unfolds naturally. One would have that sense in them. A bit of a sense of something uncanny. That's the way I would think of it. That something you can't quite pin down about them. Something a little bit, other. A bit, not strange. Well, it might be strange in a way. But yes, uncanny is a good word. Uncanny in the sense that you can't ken it, you can't know it. Something a little bit incomprehensible about them. For me, my richest experience of that is Sangharakshita, because I've got to know him quite well over many, many years. And it's partly an unpredictability. You just never know quite how he's going to respond. But it isn't whimsicality, if you see what I mean. It's that he's got a sort of another gear that I'm not myself sufficiently in touch with to be able to predict. I often quote, perhaps in a lower level, but still it makes the point, it's something that the first biographer of Milton said. This was his son-in-law, I think, who wrote of him that he'd talked to many, many people who'd known Milton, known John Milton, but he'd never found anybody who could with certainty apply motives to his actions. So there's something of that with a stream entrant. You can't quite pin it down. And when you do think you've pinned it down, it's merely because you've projected your own egotistical way of looking at things onto him. But there's something about him that you can't quite pin down. Yes, you can't define. That would be the characteristic of the Savaka Sangho. There would be a definite sense of it, a sort of tingle in the atmosphere that came from somewhere else, from beyond. But at the same time, that wasn't weird or whimsical. Or merely supernatural. I've met people who obviously have some sort of magical power, people who sort of engaged in magic and so forth. It used to be around a lot in the 60s. They're probably around now too. But you definitely met people who you thought, yeah, they've really have got a touch of maybe a bit of black magic or something like that. You could feel it in them. But this is something different from that. It's not to do with power necessarily. It's something to do with a broader a dimension, a wider skies, brighter light. It's something of that. So that's what that means. That's the way I would put it, not just a sort of doctrinal set of categories, but there's something there of individuality that's more than normal, more than we encounter normally, and where we cannot apply our psychology fully to them. They may do things that, if we did them, would be very easy for us to say, we did it because of this. It's not necessarily the case. And again, I've so often experienced that in Sangha Rakshita. Things even that have appeared to me to be not good, maybe are mistakes or whatever, but I can't simply, I cannot in the end apply my own categories to it. There's something that eludes definition. So, that is the characteristic of the true Sangha. It's proceeding happily, in a happy, serene way. Serenely, I like that term. It's going along, it's moving in a very direct way, keeping the heart of the matter in view, applying itself very direct. Its members are applying themselves very directly, they're applying themselves collectively, directly to what the Dhamma life is really about. They're going methodically, they're doing, applying the basics and then what follows on from that. They're not just going whimsically here, there. And they're in harmony because they share the highest possible ideals. And there is something of them that is more than ordinary. There's something super ordinary. Oh yes, there's in the Udanas, that's famous simile of the mighty ocean. The Dhamma is like the mighty ocean. You know, there are 8 similes for the mighty ocean. And one of those similes is that in the great ocean, there are monsters. There are strange beasts in the depths of the ocean. Praying mantises, vast praying mantises, and huge squids, and all sorts of very, very exotic creatures live in the depths of the ocean. And, you don't usually see them. You just see a flash of a fin, a little bit of colour sort of under the surface, a vague light under the surface. You can't really see it or define it properly. It lives in a medium that you cannot move in. So the Buddha said, well, the Dhamma is like that. It has within it these 4 pairs of individuals, these 8 persons, who are, yes, they swim in depths that we have not yet attained, and where we could not sustain the pressure. We need, a diving suit with pressure in it, which is, I suppose, what the conceptual Dhamma gives us. It gives us a little bit of a glimpse into those depths. So then, the Buddha said that that Sangha is Ahunneyo, which means worthy of respect, worthy of worship even. Sorry, just let me check my notes. Yes. Yes, worthy of respect or worship. Worship in the Buddhist sense of honouring those who have something greater than oneself. You're looking a bit stunned. I'm sorry I'm talking so much. But anyway, I'll finish off and then we can open up a bit. So yes, it's the members of the Sangha, of the true Sangha, are worthy of our respect, worthy of our honour. They are worthy of hospitality, pahuneo, worthy of being received with open doors, so that you let them into your life, if you like. A healthy society honours its great individuals and has some place for them, enables them to move within it. This is constantly emphasised in the Buddhist tradition. I've just been reading some of the rock edicts of Ashoka, which are very, very interesting. So in 3rd century BC India, Ashoka put up these rock pillars enjoining upon his subjects a worthy life, a worthwhile life, which was mainly a moral life. But one of the things he emphasised again and again is make those who are worthy, welcome. Give them hospitality. Let them into your life. They will give you blessing. They will open your life up. And to emphasize, not just those who are Buddhists. Brahmins and Shramanas from all different communities, even though he himself was an absolutely convinced Buddhist. He fostered and even supported other religious movements in his own society, which is quite interesting. It's a truly non-sectarian society, not secular, but non-sectarian. Which didn't mean that he didn't think, perhaps, that the Buddha was the best, but he wanted everybody to be able to find that out for themselves and to follow the way that they were attracted to, so long as it generated real moral qualities. Yes, so open your doors to those who are worthy of respect. Open your heart to them. Get into contact with them. So that, if you like, if you have a sangha within a larger society, that larger society needs to have some interaction with its best and noblest. This is the sort of Buddhist ideal, that you have those who are plumbing the depths in a creative, a positive interaction with those who don't choose to do that, those who choose to live, quotes unquote, an ordinary life. If a society doesn't have those healthy means of connection with people living a worthier life, even the artists and creative individuals, it will break itself. Again, I think this is one of the lessons of Soviet Russia, that they eliminated anybody of any creative worth and stifled. Even people like Shostakovich, Prokofiev, were not able to do everything they could because of that repressive regime. And that cannot but be unhealthy. Sanger actually has spoken quite a bit about this. He thinks that for a society to be a healthy one, there needs to be a sort of permeability. It shouldn't be official and too much sort of officially sanctioned, because that then becomes corrupted. But there needs to be a sense that that the higher life is valued and honoured. I think this is why it's important that there is support for the arts, the government does provide benefits to those living religious life of any kind, even if it's only charitable status. It's very, very important that a society recognises that there is another kind of, a higher kind of option or a dimension. Otherwise, it all just becomes flat, and we simply become competing egos, as it were, trying to get the best we can, which is what democracy so often becomes, unless it retains its idealism, which it very rarely does. So yes, there needs to be that sort of sense of honour, respect for those of genuine worth. Not always easy to tell who they are. So in a way, the Buddha says, well, don't be choosy. Just respect those who are aspiring to, or trying to, or seem to be trying to live a decent life, a better life, a higher kind of life, even if it turns out they're mistaken. Then they're worthy of dakshin, which means offering. So they need support. They need food and lodging and clothes and so forth. They need just the basics of survival. So make sure they have that. Again, a healthy society is enabling people who want to live a higher kind of life to do so at a very basic level. It's not not keeping them in luxury. That would betray their life they're trying to lead. But it's keeping them alive and then letting them follow on from there. And Anjali Karaniyo. Anjali is the folded hands, salutation with folded hands. So they're worthy of being given respect. So that you allow that the respect that you feel for those who seem to you, or you feel are leading a better kind of life, you allow that respect to show itself. If you stifle it, it will die. If you don't act upon your impulses of respect, as upon your impulses of gratitude or whatever, they die. Blake says, doesn't he, that better to strangle better to strangle a babe at birth than to nurse unacted desires. Now, I didn't mean, you know, go out and rape and pillage if you feel like it. What he meant by desires was higher impulses, in the sense of creative impulses, which would very much include impulses of generosity, impulses of respect, impulses of reverence, impulses of faith, and so on. So act upon them. They're worthy, these people, if you come across them, if you have some glimmer of that in anybody, well, show it. It doesn't mean that you should suspend your critical judgment, doesn't mean that you should stop thinking, act upon your feeling of genuine respect. If it's not genuine, it'll come out. It'll show itself. You'll realise it. And if they're worth their salt, they won't want it, if you see what I mean. So, this is the Sangha. There's one more thing. Anuttarang punyaketang lokasati. This is an interesting idea. Punyaketang. Keta is a field, kshetra, in modern Indian languages, is a field. And punya is merit. It's the outcome of your skillful action, the karmic fruit of your skillful action. What is a field? It's where you sow and reap, where you sow and harvest. These individuals, this true Sangha, is a field of merit. If you act in the ways that are talked about, if you show them honour and respect, if you make offerings to them, if you welcome them, and so forth, then that will gain merit for you. Unfortunately, this is quite often used as part of what's been called the merit economy, which is a pernicious, undermining feature of modern Eastern Buddhism, where the monastic sangha sort of claims donations because that will give people merit, and you get the argument like you're giving to the rogue, not to the man, and so on. So it doesn't matter if he's a complete rogue and not really going for refuge. The main thing is he's got the robe on. And this becomes then a sort of, on the part of the lay people, a kind of vicarious satisfaction. It's a way of just giving a bit of a spiritual gloss to their thoroughly ordinary lives. And it keeps the monks in bread so that they can get a good education and then get top jobs in the civil service in Thailand, for instance. I'm sure there are good monks who use that well. But all that is not in a robe is not genuinely practicing the Dhamma. So this language of merit is abused, but there is a truth behind it. If you see something or somebody who seems to you worthy, and you have some sense of respect and gratitude towards them, that is good for you. That's the way you could put it. It brings about an increase in your own idealism, your own experience of the ideal, if you see what I mean. You're acting upon it. There's quite a bit more to be said about that, but I feel I'm sort of speaking far too much, so I should just draw to a close. Savaka Sangho is ahuneyo, worthy of worship, pahuneyo, to be given hospitality, dakineyo, to be made offerings to be anjali karaneyo, to be saluted with folded hands, and it's an unsurpassed anuttarang punyaketam field of merit, lokasati, in the world. So individuals who are genuinely leading a higher life, whether it's in the aesthetic or artistic sphere, or in the spiritual sphere, or in the sphere of true scholarship, are worthy of respect, because they're trying to unfold and realise ideals that are important for everybody. And by honouring those who embody those, you are strengthening those ideals in yourself. That's, for instance, why it's so important to go on pilgrimage. The Buddha said that if you go on pilgrimage, it's a source of merit for you. Because when you go to Bodhgaya, you are showing that Buddhahood is worth it for you. It's worth making the journey. It's worth spending the money. It's worth putting up with the horrors of Bodhgaya. It's worth putting up with the crudity of so much Buddhist pilgrimage. It's worth it because it expresses your a feeling for that ideal. That ideal will be strengthened in you, and you will get the merit from that. I've experienced that very directly. Merit as a sense of some fulfilment, some satisfaction, some growth. So even in honouring those who appear to be worthy of honour, even if it turns out that they're not, something is still strengthened. You've learnt a lesson, hopefully, but still something was strengthened in you. If you do not act on it, it parches, a seed without water, it just dies. So better to act on those impulses, those desires in the Blakean sense, even if it turns out they were misguided, and then you'll learn. But don't fall into cynicism, which is of course the refuge of the betrayed. You refuse to move because you've been betrayed. You will be betrayed. It's the fourth noble truth. No, the fifth noble truth. You will be betrayed. As long as you've illusions, they will be betrayed. That's guaranteed. And in fact, if you learn from betrayal, it's one of the most important experiences you can have. But do not hold back. Act on your impulses of a higher kind. If they're mixed, you'll find out. If you're honest, you'll find out. So yes, this is the Sangha. It's of this kind. Throughout your life, throughout my life, as long as my life lasts, that Sangha will be my ideal. I will go for refuge to it. I will continue to seek it out. I will continue to try to realise it in my own experience. This is what you're saying. I'll try to bring it about. I will strive with my poor, foolish brothers and sisters in the order, misguided as they are, to bring it about. And misguided as I am as well. I will try to bring it about together. And every Sangha in the past, and there have been many, many Sanghas that have tried to do this in the past. You know that wonderful talk by Bhante about the history of spiritual community? It's a very, very good talk, which is hardly used. I can't remember what it's called now. What's it called? It was given at a convention many, many years ago. It's little heard. But he's sort of saying what is real history is the history of the struggle of individuals and collections of individuals to create spiritual community. And he talks about it in many, many different contexts, and religious communities of all different kinds. You see the same struggle going on to create the ideal society. In political movements, you see that struggle going on. In movements, he got very interested in movements like in early 19th century America, a lot of idealist movements, the Oneida community and so on and so forth. Fascinating. In the 60s, we had a very strong sense that we should be creating an ideal community. That's what this movement has come out of, really. So he said the real history of the world is not the history of the struggles of great powers. The real history of the world is the struggle of individuals to develop, and of groups of individuals to create the ideal community. That's the real history of the world. And he sort of gave a kind of sketch of what that might be, but it's a big subject for a historian. Where is he? Anyway, somebody should write that history on a big scale. The world history, the real world history. And of course, any Sangha in the future. They have my full, my sympathy, because it's not easy. Very disillusioning, very painful at times, but it's the only struggle that's worthwhile. There will be individuals in the future, and groups of individuals in the future who will make that attempt. Buddhists, non-Buddhists, many, many different kinds, and they are to be respected, to be honoured. Of course, those who've really achieved stream entry and beyond are the real sanghas that one is going for refuge to, of the past, the present, and the future. Yes, and to all those real sanghas, my worship flows unceasingly. And, actually, my deepest respects and sympathy flow to all those even who've tried, whatever kind. They're all my brothers and sisters. They've tried to do what I'm trying to do. That's the true refuge. There's no other refuge. This struggle of humanity to achieve the ideal society. This is the true refuge. And those who've achieved it to any degree are really to be taken refuge in. And by the virtue of this truth, their grace abound and victory. And then these very, very strong and poignant words, Uttamangena Vandeham, placing my topmost limb at their feet, at the feet of all the sanghas of the past, present and future, with body, speech and mind, I salute them. And if in any way I had betrayed the ideal of Sangha, if I betrayed my Sangha, may that Sangha bear with me. May the ideal, the Arya Sangha bear with me. May my own brothers and sisters bear with me. This is the sort of mood that it ends with, which I think is very profound, and something that we need to think of both on the ideal level and on the effective level, that we are constantly letting our community down. We cannot help it, but please keep going with me. Please bear with me, as we say, and I will bear with you. Together, we will slowly, slowly create something that is of lasting value. And that will bring something into the world that the world desperately needs, above all. But there you are. That's the Sangha